thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for inviting me.
Of course.
I'm excited. I'm really happy I had time to train over time to be on camera like this, because 2 years, 3 years ago, I would be like, no, Alec,
Well, it's important for people like you to be on camera to help dispel the myths surrounding virology and all this other nonsense that we're doing, because you're a credentialed expert. So we need more credentialed experts like you speaking out.
Yeah. Somehow I have my credentials. I don't know how I got them, because I mean, now looking back, what I had to learn and incorporate as truth is like, wow, I don't even know how. I didn't start questioning things earlier, because now you look back and you're like, nothing makes sense. So, well,
yeah. Yeah. And I want to get to that too. I want to get to like your background to set the context of where we're about to go with this conversation. So I want to preface this by saying I've obviously given a lot of presentations on the pseudoscience of virology, and I've never spoken directly to either PCR or sequencing. I've touched on it quite a bit and I understand it pretty well. But the reason I think it's so important to touch on this pretty extensively is because what we see happening across the landscape of available experts who are proponents of virology is a lot of them are starting to acknowledge that the cell culture isolation process is nonsense. But then they'll say, but it doesn't matter because we have a full genomic sequence of this that we're finding in patients all over the world. This is being replicated in labs, yada, yada, yada. So because of that, because they're acknowledging that and then shifting over to the sequencing nonsense, I think it's important to cover this extensively too. And I thought it'd be best to have you, someone who's familiar with sequencing, a trained molecular biologist, on this discussion. So could you just start with a background of your education and then lead up to how you shifted through the cognitive dissonance of understanding that there's actually no validity for viruses?
Yep. So I finished biology in Italy. I'm originally from Slovenia, but I finished biology in Italy and molecular biology grad school. So I have a PhD in molecular biology. And back in 1995, when I started my undergrad work, after a few months, there was a PCR reaction that we were supposed to set up to amplify a gene in bacteria to do some what's called cloning and expression of protein and so on and so forth. And I never even thought about, oh boy, 30 years later or whatever, 27, 25 years later, we would be talking extensively about PCR and what it is and why it cannot do what they say it does, right? So I moved to the US, still studying some sort of bacteria, transcription, mRNA. So I kind of know something about mRNA and translation and how it theoretically produces protein. But again, there is a lot to talk about in this mRNA in the context of the vaccine. Probably we won't go there today because there will be so much to talk about. PCR and stuff. So then my first thing was, so in 2008, I moved and started in genetics department or in cancer center in a genetics lab. So it was like predisposition, like genetic predisposition to human cancers. And I was all on board and I'm like, yeah, you know, it's all in our genes and this and that. And then when I realized, oh, actually lifestyle, and I went through nutrition, so it's not like lifestyle as traumas and thoughts and all of that, but I just went from basic what we eat and we need to move and this and that. So then I started seeing the disconnect between what I knew was would like a correct lifestyle would keep us away from all this trouble. And in the lab, we were just chasing after things. I mean, we are not even going to go like things, what things.
It was kind of your personal experience that led you to understand that like this is all starting to look like nonsense to me because I'm seeing real world results out of here. And all of the pharmaceutical industry is based on the so-called studies and these experiments that we're doing in a lab that are derived from what I'm doing here with molecular biology and, of course, virology and microbiology and all those things. And you were seeing these opposite results in your own life. So you're like, where's the disconnect here?
You always put it so nicely, Alec. Thank you so much. I'm like thousand
That's
words.
That's all I'm good at. I'm good at taking like what other people say and breaking it down in layman's terms. Yeah.
That's, I already try to put it so everybody understands, but you really put it. Thank you so much. So exactly, this is what it was. I mean, and I started being heavily involved in the biggest, most important bike ride to raise money for cancer research that was at The Ohio State University. And I was like all in it. And then this was before I started looking into nutrition. So I was all in it. And I'm like, yeah, we are going to find a cure. Few years down the road, I'm like, oh, Yerneya, you spent a lot of time and energy. I mean, a lot. I was invested. They called me Queen of Pelotonia. This is how the bike ride is called. And I mean, the CEO of Cancer Center. Now I know why he praised me and called me like that, because they're all about the money. And they even said it. So it's a lot of stuff that I experienced that made me stop and pause and start questioning. Because when the co-organizer or the co-founder of this bike ride to raise money for cancer research at Ohio State, when he met with some people and I heard later on, he said, oh yeah, because I see you all as dollar signs. Wait a minute.
Wow.
Wait a minute. This is still, this was maybe in 2015, 2014. So a long time ago, let's call it. I mean, at this point, let's call it, because the last 3 years was like, it feels like it's 30 years went by, right?
Oh my
in the
gosh,
last
yes.
3 years. So it was a long time ago that I'm like, something is not making sense. And then at my new job, once I moved to a cancer center in Southern California, at one point I brought up in what is called the journal club. So where we are discussing research papers about biology of prevention. So they were all about this and that and complicated stuff and analyzing. And I couldn't understand most of it. I thought I was the stupid one because I just couldn't follow where they were going. But now I know what it is. It's like nature is simple and it's basic and 1 + 1 = 2. If you need to start going round and round and round, then something doesn't, it's something's not right. Correct.
I would imagine, especially like on the molecular level, because of all the procedures you're having to deal with a ton of assumptions in that process that have sort of become accepted amongst modern biology altogether, right?
Yes. Yes. It's just accepted. It's just accepted that when you do a certain reaction, what you get out as an output, you just assume this is the protein, but it's just some sort of a signal. And let's not go into, usually you detect it with antibodies, and let's not go into all the research our friend Mike Stone has done about antibodies. I keep sharing that with people. I'm like, people just stop like pushing antibodies on me, because yeah. it's nonsense. So there is a lot of stuff that now I look back, I'm like, yes. I mean, I didn't question. So back when I started grad school or undergrad, when I started in the lab, I was this like young student working with a professor who was probably 20, 30 years older than me, right? And experience and this and that. So you just, even if something doesn't feel right, even if you might think something is a little off, but again, who are you to question? You are like 20 some, right? Who are you to question somebody who's been in the field? You just don't do it. I mean, some people, of course, leave. Some people at some point, they're like, no, this is just too much for my poor brain. I mean, this just doesn't make sense. So some people leave. And for some, it was just, okay, well, this is how it is. And you just move on. And now I think that I know I had to go through the whole thing, because if I was not speaking about the freaking PCR, there is nobody out there. Is it correct? I mean, I'm just...
There's a couple, but very few people that are credentialed like you speaking out about PCR.
That's the thing. I mean, I have all my titles and this and that, and people want to see that. And still, I'm shut down by friends. I mean, they shut me down when I started telling them in spring 2020, look, guys, this is not... what it seems. So stop. Oh, you're Nea. What do you know? Okay, whatever. So fast forward then to like 2020, right? So what happened? This was like, I think it was a miracle, but that's just me. I was listening. So something started being off and all of a sudden we were locked down, right? So all of a sudden, so they laugh at you when you bring up lifestyle change, but then they lock you down for your health. So again, it's this 1+1 all of a sudden doesn't make 2, right? It's off. So somehow, I don't even know how I came across Dr. Andy Kaufman speaking with Spiro, the activist. So I still remember that video, and Andy brought up the whole exosomes and this and that, and I'm like, oh, I don't know. And then he says the magic word, oh, and PCR is the test that is used to find these cases. And I'm like, wait a second. What? I mean, a light turned on. So what happened was, wait a second, Carey Mullis, I've heard much about him in 1995 when I started working with it. It was like, oh yeah, Carey Mullis, this amazing like scientist, blah, 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 invented this thing. So brought to mind the name of Carey Mullis. And then also brought to mind that at some point during my career, at some point I came across Carey Mullis as a conspiracy theorist. Mm-hmm. So he was presented to me sometime down the road, I don't know, in 2000 something, 2010, I don't know. I cannot pinpoint like exactly what date, but at some point, Carey Mullis, the conspiracy theorist. So then I'm like, wait a minute. Again.
Because previous to that, he was Carey Mullis, the Nobel Prize winner and inventor of PCR. And then out of nowhere is Carey Mullis, the conspiracy theorist.
And at that point for me, back in the day, he was a conspiracy theorist. I'm like, oh yeah. I never even looked into HIV. I didn't look into that because, and this is what they kind of push you to do, right? I mean, you're like, oh yeah, don't look into that because it's a conspiracy theory and you're a scientist. So, you know, you won't look into that. But then I'm like, look, so I've had my experience with a paper from my coworker that was published in Science. So Science, Nature, The Lancet, New England Journal of Medicine, those are top of the top. Once you publish there, it's like you can be on the list of, you know, being the next Nobel Prize winner, right? For whatever it is, medicine or whatever. So it was a big deal when that was published. But once I started looking into raw data that are published in that paper, I'm like, oh, PCR was used in a way and gave certain results. So something was off with that PCR technology that was used in there. So I started really looking into how PCR works. So it's not just like, because a lot of people just use it and they use it and they design those primers. We will go through the whole thing, like what PCR reaction is and how it works. But people just use it. And I really had to look into why my former coworker was able to produce data that didn't make sense. How? And she didn't know. And I'm 100%, I'm really 100% sure that she didn't do it on purpose. She was just not educated enough. She was fresh out of grad school. Our supervisor trusted her fully. At that point, I was already maybe 10 years out of grad school. So I had my experiences. So I went looking deeper and she just, oh yeah, this is what it is. So.
Well, that brings up a good point because Mike Donio's talked about this a little bit. It's not that all scientists are in on it. Like there it's, that, no. It's like a ridiculous notion. People bring that up. What you're saying, all virologists and molecular biologists are in on it. No, they're not in on it. They've been trained on these procedures, and they have been taught not to question them. These procedures produce viruses. We already know that they produce viruses. PCR is able to test for, you know, certain pieces of genetic material. We already know this. when you've been conditioned to already know something, in air quotes. It's not that you're in on it. You are just conditioned into the belief system that promotes that thing. And that's would apply to the overwhelming majority of credentialed experts who are pushing this nonsense.
Yes. Yes. And it's, I mean, just last week, there was a group of, I don't know if they were donors. I still work at my institution. So because I went very smartly about this whole thing and I spoke up first in Slovene, so nobody understood. And now at this point, I mean, there is so much information. Now I saw New York Times published how masks really don't work. So it's in New York Times. So that is a kind of article that I can actually send to my human resources who recalled me because 3 times I was reported for not wearing the mask. So mm-hmm. I can now send that article and be like, look, guys, I was just a little ahead of time. And you still wrote me in your little book of, you know, people that don't listen, right? So these people came to the lab next door and the professor was all about, oh, yeah, what we are doing in our lab is we prevent cancer. And again, I started laughing. I mean, I could have cried, but I'm like, you know, at this point, what I do, I usually just laugh because there is nothing else that I can do, because this is the person that laughed at me before. He heard me speak about lifestyle change, this and that. Let's look into. So it's the same person who years later, oh yeah, we are working on cancer prevention. So then what he says, he asks them a question. He goes, do you know what is the biggest risk for people to develop cancer? And I'm like, I know where you're going. It's age. So they think it's age as a number, but we know what it is, accumulation of toxins. And then, of course, especially if we know what cancer is, because they also have the wrong idea of what cancer is, right? If cancer is something that forms because your body is cleaning stuff and putting it in a place. And then what they do biopsies, so they puncture. I mean, it's the whole inverted thing. So, and that's why they are not in on it as willingly and knowingly, let's say, but they just go with all the assumption, yeah. And when they talk about inflammation, they just go, inflammation just happens. This is just what it is, and then leads to cancer. So how do we interrupt this pathway where inflammation leads to cancer? They won't go and see, okay, what is inflammation? Why does it happen? Or like going back to the root. Nobody goes back to the root. So, I mean, when
you just... Even the emotional, psycho-spiritual implications for that too.
They don't even know what that is. Mm-hmm. I was completely one of them, a completely disconnected, like soul was not connected to where it should be connected. Or maybe it was, but I was just like pushing it down. I don't know how that works. But yeah, so it's, no, they don't think, they don't know trauma. They don't know all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. No idea. Just going so materialistic. Yeah. It's this and it's that. And let's create a new molecule that will interrupt this pathway and we're going to be good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and this is why science, and I put that in air quotes, based on scientific consensus is not only nonsense, it's also extremely harmful, because the implications for that when it comes to health, let's just stay in health rather than in, like, you know, material sciences or like just the nature of reality or anything like that. When it comes to health, when your foundation is not based in actually proving cause and effect via the scientific method, via the rigorous, very specific, throwing out all assumptions, ensuring that there's no confounding variables interacting with it, scientific method proving cause and effect, when it's based on this scientific consensus, which is riddled with assumptions, riddled with logical fallacies, riddled with models and theories and simulations, then the end result is a much less healthy population. And that's what we see happening. Yes, you know, maybe the argument on longevity aside, I actually don't know that we're living longer today than we did 200 to 300 years ago. I think that's actually a lie. But the point is, we're living, but we're just existing. That's why so many people are unhealthy right now. I mean, 54% of kids have a chronic disease, at least one chronic disease right now. Cancer rates are skyrocketing, obesity skyrocketing, depression, mental illness, so to speak, mental illness in air quotes is skyrocketing, all these things. And I think it all goes back to the foundation of having science established based on consensus rather than based on it strictly adhering to the scientific method and proving cause and effect. Can you touch on that a little bit?
So what I will, so that's true. I mean, nobody's looking at the cause effect, and what I'm realizing, they are actually inverting them, or they think that, okay, so let's go to the specific example that I actually learned about. So usually they say a mutation will lead to cancer. So let's say in your cell, you get a mutation, and then this mutated some protein, something, this will lead to development of cancer. There is a guy, I think he presented at our medical center maybe 4 years ago. I cannot find now. I have it somewhere in my notes. I need to go because COVID took over all of my notes. So I don't know. I need to go back. I don't remember his name, but he's from Berkeley. I think he's from Berkeley or from Stanford, from one of those fancy universities that if you mention somebody from there, they'll be like, yeah. But as soon as you mention his results, they will shut you down. Why? So what he actually found out, he's saying, oh, what I actually see is that, and now to me that makes perfect sense, that first you have cancer, like some change, some cells are super multiplying or something. And then you start accumulating mutations. Duh. If you have, who knows what is in those cells, right? What is accumulating? What is being detoxed? Definitely that will affect your DNA. If we just stay, as you said, if we don't go all into the nature of reality and then everything is like everything falls apart. But if we just stay in what we look in sciences, right? So when that guy presented, oh, yeah, interesting. But then no more discussion. After that first, oh, yeah, very interesting. And then it all dies down. The same was with one research paper. I was at the American Society of Human Genetics conference, and they were talking about one mutation in a gene. So it's a TP53. It's a gene that's very often mutated, and that causes a lot of different cancers. So what they found now, when they can sequence pretty much everybody, right? So now they have a lot of these like human genomes that are sequenced and deposited in banks. So what they went and they looked into flosses, I think they're called. So it's females that never had cancer that are of a certain age, like 80 plus. They found TP53 or P53 mutations in pretty much all of them. So women 70 plus never had cancer. They all had mutation in the gene that everybody screams about. If you have mutation there, you will get cancer and you're going to die. Because they love adding, you're going to die. Yep. Program you constantly. So, and I shared this with a professor that's in my building, who was actually involved in that group of people that discovered BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. So the genes that are predisposing, or mutations in the genes that are predisposing for breast cancer. So I shared that with her. Oh, interesting.
That's it, though. Just interesting.
Stop. And that was it. So you see, I mean, this is why I was not too surprised when I heard certain things in spring 2020, because I'm like, look, they ignore this, they ignore that, they ignore that. And now all of a sudden, stay home, stay safe, blah, 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 this and that. I'm like, something just doesn't add up.
And well, this is actually a perfect segue too, because you're talking about finding these gene mutations in people, and these gene mutations are said to be the cause of cancer, but they're found in people who are well into elderly age that don't have cancer. So it kind of sounds like how, you know, we had Koch's postulates, right? And that was established. And let me just read them real quick. Mm-hmm. One, the microorganism must be found in abundance in all organisms suffering from the disease, but should not be found in healthy organisms. Two, the microorganism must be isolated from a diseased organism and grown in a pure culture. Three, the cultured microorganism should cause disease when introduced into a healthy organism. Four, the microorganism must be re-isolated from the inoculated diseased experimental host and identified as being identical to the original specific causative agent. So the reason I bring this up, that does not relate at all to genes and cancer, but what it does relate to is the poking holes in this scientific dogma where in the example of cancer, oh, this gene is what caused cancer, but how come we're finding it in other people? When it comes to Koch's postulates as it applies to bacteria, which we're not going to discuss for this, but how come we're finding this bacteria in people who are not presently sick? Or how come when we expose people who are healthy to this isolated form of bacteria, they are not replicating symptoms of illness? But Koch's postulates really is, you could say, just based in the scientific method. It's attempting to prove cause and effect, right? With an independent variable to see if it produces the dependent variable, the observed phenomenon at question. And with virology, they've essentially said, Koch's postulates is irrelevant because viruses are obligate intracellular parasites. We require a host cell in order to replicate. And of course, there's a lot of fallacies there that I pointed out before, because there's said to be 200 million viral particles in one sneeze, and you can't, you know, take those particles and then expose them to a healthy host and replicate symptoms, nor can you put those in a culture or just purify and isolate them directly without introducing them to other genetic material. But yeah, I want you to take it from there within the context of sequencing.
After a few months of this whole nonsense, when I finally realized, you know, nothing's there really. I mean, I was not aware that the virus is not there, but I just knew that something is off about.
Something was off. Yeah.
Yeah. So my husband actually, so he's also a molecular biologist, PhD, the same thing. We worked in the same labs for a while, and later on we split. So what he did, because we didn't have much virology back in the 90s, he actually bought both volumes of these Principles of Virology, because he's like, let's see what is written in these books, right? So somehow this is the first thing that I somehow came across and I found. I started reading the book and I'm like, wow, this is ridiculous. Oh, this is weird. But then I came across this. So,
you mind if I read this out loud real quick?
Yes. Can you please do that? Yeah.
Okay. So this is in, the title says Why Viruses May Not Fulfill Koch's Postulates. Although Koch's postulates provided a framework to identify a pathogen unambiguously as an agent of a particular disease, some infectious agents, including viruses, cause disease but do not adhere to all of the postulates. In fact, it has been argued that the rigid application of these criteria to viral agents may have impeded early progress in the field of virology. Koch himself became aware of the limitations of his postulates upon discovering that Vibrio cholera, the agent of cholera, could be isolated from both sick and healthy individuals.
So, I mean, right, Alec, for a sane person, this is enough to say, wait a minute, instead of throwing Koch postulates out, let's throw out the so-called viral agents as the agents of something, right? I mean, this is this upside-down world that reveals to you, I mean, reveals itself to you if you are willing to.
Yeah.
And observe.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
so what goes with this? So what goes with this image is under this box. More sensitive technologies, including DNA sequencing, have triggered a reconsideration of Koch's postulates. So standard techniques would be this culturing and this and that. And then we have the PCR machine and this would be probably like the sequencing result. So it's
So for the people that are listening to this and just listening to the audio version of the podcast, what she has, I'll narrate as we go. It's okay. Yeah. What she has up right here is showing the standard technique, which is like lab culturing and using some lab procedures. And then it has a versus, and then it has a computer and some machinery, which again implies simulation in silico, meaning a theoretical computer model. It's showing that these old techniques, these standard techniques, are sort of moving aside, and we have these new techniques to take the place of virology not being able to adhere to either Koch's postulates or to the scientific method.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to me, it's weird now, but probably 20 years ago, I would have said, yeah, it's all good. Let's move on and let's use PCR. So should we just move on and go into the PCR? So to really see what...
Either way, because we're gonna touch on PCR and sequencing, whatever you feel is most appropriate.
Yes. Let's do so. I made this thing so people at least understand. And please interrupt me if it's something that you want to point out more like for laymen so they can understand, but I try to put things in the way that's understandable, right? So first we need to know this SARS-CoV-2, they say it's an RNA virus, right? So it has RNA, which is ribonucleus, whatever. It's ribo, and this is
ribonucleic acid.
Ribonucleic acid. Yes, I wanted to say it in Slovene, but whatever. And this is deoxyribonucleic acid. That's DNA. So PCR can only work on DNA. So there is an additional step of retrotranscription. So you create DNA molecule from RNA. We will skip that part because that's just an additional part which actually does add mutation. So you actually have the result of that retrotranscription. You have already a molecule that most probably is not exactly the same from the RNA that you started with. So the sequence is not exactly the same. So you already start with that. So, but then what do we put in? So in this PCR tube, we put in all of the genetic material, especially if they didn't purify it. What they usually do, they just put it through it's our viral RNA purification kit. And just because it says viral RNA purification kit, it doesn't mean that it's purifying just viral RNA. Mm-hmm. This is again just I think it's just like black magic making people think that it's just viral. I mean, students will be like, oh yeah, this is to isolate viral RNA. And it's not, isolates all the RNA molecules that are in the sample. So if nothing is isolated, then you put in everything. So then you use a couple of primers, and I will show them later. One primer is at the beginning, you would say at the beginning of what you're trying to amplify, like the gene of interest. And the other primer is at the end. Then you have these building blocks that are nucleotides, AGTC. Do I have another slide? Give me a second here. Actually, there is this other one where, sorry, I recreated this one. So this is the forward primer. We call it the forward primer. This is the reverse primer. Polymerase, I would call, is the brick layer if we call these nucleotides as bricks, right? That are constructing when you put them in sequence one after the other, like this one after the other, they would create one strand, and then complementary, you create another strand. Mm-hmm. And these nucleotides actually, they pair as G goes with the C and A goes with the T. T goes with the A. So let's say if this sequence is GATC, on the opposite strand, you will have CTA and G.
Got it.
Okay. So all of this stuff is swimming in your tube. And then what is a cycle? A cycle is actually, so when they were saying, they run for 45 cycles or 35 cycles, whatever. You can only do 25 cycles for PCR to be even usable. So cycles are actually changes in temperature. So at first, it's 95 degrees where you open this DNA, this double helix that you have here. Then mm-hmm. you have 56, it's around 56 to 60 some degrees where these two complementary sequences anneal with each one with its own strand. And then you have temperature at 72 degrees when this polymerase, this bricklayer guy here, is just adding bricks starting from here. Okay, yeah. So this is kind of, I made something, so I think this is easier to see. So first you open, then you anneal this guy, the red one anneals here, the purple one anneals here, and you extend, and it actually extends, you see, it extends all the way until the temperature changes to 95. So this can go for a while on this DNA that you have in the tube. So then you have, so this is the first cycle. Then you have the next cycle. Again, you do 95 degrees. You open everything up again. So you have from two molecules, so two double strands, you get to four single strands, right? So it's got just it. One strand. So
and it's like the sort of doubling effect, right? Where it continues to double and double.
Yes.
And double.
So it always continues to double. And at some point, most of the resulting molecules are this. So what happens in the next cycle, you actually, when you anneal this one on the purple with the blue, right? So on this one, when you anneal the red, the forward primer, you actually can only extend until where this primer starts or ends, whichever. Usually we call this the start of the primer in this direction. Okay. So what it creates at the end, you have a huge number of these type of molecules where you have exactly the start of the molecule is at the beginning of the forward primer and the end of the molecule is at the beginning of the reverse primer because this is the beginning and the beginning. Every cycle you duplicate the amount. But actually what happens is with 10 cycles from one molecule, you already have 1,000 molecules.
Yep.
From 15, you have 32,000 and so on and so forth. I mean, what is this number over here with 30 cycles from one molecule? So it's insane number of molecules. And what we need to realize is that during every cycle, polymerase that attaches these building blocks to this primer and extends, it creates mutations. So it can, instead of putting a G, let's say, opposite to a C, sometimes it can put a T.
Got it.
Or an A or whatever. So mistakes happen. So you're actually creating, so down here, if you do 30 cycles or 35 or 40, the sequence is definitely, for a lot of them, it's not the same as what you started with. Okay. So when they run this test, like the PCR test for COVID, let's say they have these primers that are detecting E gene or whatever they say and the N gene. I think that's how they call those genes that somehow they found in this sequence. So what they actually measure is the fluorescence that is emitted when, so let's go back here. In real-time PCR, which is what is really used for this test, you have another primer over here, which is called a probe. And this probe emits fluorescence when you are extending. So when from this primer you run into this probe, it actually starts digesting it and fluorescence is emitted. So let's not go again into that whole thing, but just so we know, this is where, this is the emission of fluorescence, right? And there is a level where the machine is not able to detect it. And then at some point, it goes over what's called the threshold. So let's say that the threshold is 33 million. So you need to have 33 million molecules for the machine to really say, okay, I can detect it and this would be, it's positive.
Yeah. No. And is this where like each lab has to validate their instrumentation, like based on the accepted standard too?
Theoretically, I've never worked in what's called a CLIA lab, which is the clinical whatever research. So they have to have, so these are the labs that can run these PCR tests for diagnosis. I can run my PCR, and even if my PCR is not exactly, doesn't work exactly the same as the lab next door, let's say if in my case I get my result with the same tube, let's say we have the same stuff in the tube, and in my case I get the positive here and the lab next door gets it here, that's fine. We are not working with diagnostics. We do other stuff with this results. We have some sort of internal control, so it's relatively accepted. But a CLIA would need to definitely test. I mean, they would need to see what they're doing. And the problem is what they used for this is lab-produced sequences, lab-produced DNA or RNA material. So you're like just running in circles because, I mean, it's not virus, right? I mean,
yes, of course.
That's the thing.
And yeah, I want to get into later how they never clinically validated it either. So I'll let you continue for now though.
Yeah. I mean, so this is the thing for PCR. I think I would finish here. So this was my thing. I mean, let's understand what they were doing. And again, I know from experience. So, and my students, I always say my students know very much from experience. If they are not careful what they're doing, very often they will get some signal down here. Even in a sample where there was no DNA whatsoever in the sample. So, and it could be due to what's called primer dimer. It could be due to so many things. That's why we very often have this cutoff that anything that's beyond, I would say 33 or 32 or 34, we don't even look at it. We completely ignore it. And then for a lot of our stuff, we sequence these products. We sequence the products to really understand, is what this signal showing that I produced my molecule, or is this signal just showing that probe was chewed up, but what was produced, nobody knows. Does that make sense? So
yes.
Sequencing of it would really confirm, okay, we really produced what we said we would produce, that E gene or whatever, right?
Yep.
And not just some positive like signal due to, again, who knows what. So.
And so the implications of this, like when it comes to these specific assays that they're testing against, right? Where are those coming from? Where are they deriving these from?
Do you mean deriving?
Let's say it in more layman's terms, because I probably used the incorrect term. What are they validating this test against? Like, how do they know what they're testing for?
So what they do, so theoretically, I don't have that slide, I didn't put it in, but they would actually definitely need to put in the purified virus, right? They would need to count, let's say they would need to put like what we would call a serial dilution of viruses, mm-hmm. right? So let's say in one tube they put 10, in the other tube they put 50, in the other tube they put 100. And what happens? So this real-time PCR actually goes the other way around. So the less the sample, the higher the number, mm-hmm. right? Because you need to really amplify to get a result. So theoretically, if they were doing these serial dilutions, they would actually find, okay, with 100 viruses, my PCR test is positive at 13. I'm just coming up with like these numbers, right?
Yep.
With the lower concentration, it's 22. With, again, lower concentration is 33. And then if they would give the same, somehow these ratios to, of course, we won't test on humans, but let's say they would want to test on, of course, they always use animal models, which I'm not a fan of, but okay, for right now. So they would need to give the same different amounts to an animal model and see, okay, with which amount animal gets sick. So at that point, they could say, okay, so 22 is everything that is below 22 is not enough for anything. Everything that is, or everything that is above, sorry, the other way around. You see, I get confused. I so hate this thing now. I mean, I so hate it because it's like, I see how they're using it to manipulate. So it's just like something that, but you see, so let's say 33 is not the amount that will make everybody, anybody sick. So if you in the test get a 33, then, you know, okay. Nobody needs to worry. Nobody needs to lock down. Nobody needs to stay home and quarantine because they don't have enough virus, right? The viral load. But the problem is another, and this, I don't understand how my fellow molecular biologists, people that work with PCR, I don't know how they don't see the problem with this test. Apart from, I mean, we didn't even touch the sequence. We will go there later, but. So what we usually do, we have an internal control. So we use PCR test. We use PCR, real-time PCR, to check for gene expression. So we see if a certain gene is expressed in a cell, to what level, and so on and so forth. But what we do, so let's say a certain gene is in normal conditions expressed to a level X, and then you treat with a drug. And expression goes up by, let's say, threefold. Okay. So, but how do you know that threefold is due to the different conditions of the cell? Or if it's just due that you put too much RNA, like three times more RNA in the tube, right? So you have an internal control, which would be a gene that doesn't vary based on if you treat stuff. So usually that would be actin. As the it composes the skeletal thing of cells, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, actin or GAPDH. There are several genes that you know they don't vary. So you use that as, okay, so I know that I put the same amount of RNA in both tubes. So when one is higher than the other, the value, like the CT, so this is called the CT value. One is higher than the other. You know that it's coming from there being more or less of my specific mRNA.
Got right? It.
So in this test, we don't have any internal control. So when
I think the Corman-Drosten review report noted that the scientists who co-authored that paper pointed out that in the Corman-Drosten like PCR protocol that there was no internal control.
Yes. And this should ring a bell with every person that me and my husband approach, like our former coworkers back in the day, saying, listen, guys, you work with PCR. You should know that this is not correct. Oh, but no. They didn't want to see. So they should have known because it's a thing. I mean, we know everybody screams at you. Every boss screams at you if you forgot to use the internal control. I mean, everybody screams at you. If you don't do it. So it's a rule. You need to have it. So you know that your change in this amount is really due to my gene, not just how much RNA I put in. Because when you take the swab, you don't know what you actually swabbed, right? Did I swab enough? Did I not swab? So you would need an internal control of something, and they don't do that. So, yeah, so this is really just the problem, just with PCR without even touching sequencing.
Well, and that sort of leads us to ask, like, where are these primers coming from? Where are they actually deriving these primers from? So that's where I want to get into.
Yes. So should we just go in the whole sequencing? Because it's
let's wrap this up in layman's terms. So essentially, like, when you don't have the thing you think is the cause and you haven't established causation in any way, shape, or form, they haven't established that it even exists, nor have they established that these virus particles cause any sort of disease whatsoever. So again, when it comes to clinical validation of the accuracy of PCR, because you have never first established the cause, it is scientifically and diagnostically meaningless. And PCR, the reason I've titled this episode, The Linchpin is PCR, is because with the use of PCR at varying degrees of cycle thresholds, you could generate endless amounts of pandemics ad infinitum. So I want to bring up this paper, and I'm going to link this in the show notes too, real quick. I'm just going to share my screen. This article that came out, Faith in Quick Test Leads to Epidemic That Wasn't. Essentially, the use of PCR literally led to a whooping cough, I think it was, outbreak that didn't actually happen. It was all via the misuse of PCR. And ironically, this was published in the New York Times back in the day, but of course, they've changed their tune. But the point is that you can generate endless amounts of so-called pandemics, of course, with manipulation tactics, coercion, driving people into insane amounts of fear. And I think the important point to bring up here, and I know you want to touch on fear later, Yurneya, is that the second strongest risk factor for death associated with COVID, according to a CDC study published in July of 2021, was fear/anxiety-related disorders. So the combination of propaganda, coercion tactics, manipulation, and inducing fear amongst a massive amount of people, you can get people to almost have a film over their eyes where they're seeing in reality something that actually isn't there. And then throw PCR into the mix and you can do this forever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's bad. It's bad. That's why, I mean, once I realized that really PCR is on the... If we skip like sequencing, but let's say PCR and PCR test is at the base of the whole thing, and those numbers of on CNN and all of that stuff, cases, then I'm like, okay, I need to speak up, because this can go on forever if people don't realize that they are being fooled. I mean, completely fooled.
If you're enjoying this episode so far, please share it with a family member, a loved one, a fellow tinfoil hat conspiracy theorist, or your neighbor who thinks you're absolutely nuts. We are censored and shadow banned on virtually every platform, making it difficult for us to showcase what we're doing, so we rely on you all to help us grow. Also, if you like this podcast, please consider becoming a member of The Way Forward to support us. We put a lot of intention into what we do, and our membership has so much value. And we're so grateful for your continued support so we can keep making these episodes and providing valuable information to you. Lastly, if you have a holistic health or freedom-oriented business you run, or if you know of one, please head to or share our business directory form in the show notes. The directory is currently private, but we plan on launching it publicly soon, fully funded by the Way Forward members. Over half of the businesses in our directory offer exclusive discounts for members to The Way Forward, and we sincerely appreciate your help with onboarding these businesses to our directory so that we can drive our members to those businesses and create more value for you, our supporters. Thanks, and enjoy the rest of the episode.
Sequencing. So... one thing that I have to say, the way I was reading papers before this pandemic, again, quote unquote pandemic, was I would read the abstract and then I would read kind of results and then conclusions and maybe criticize them. And I usually, I mean, not just me, usually we would skip methodology. So, but what I learned, especially from Dr. Kaufman being so methodology, everything he would find was it in methodology. So I'm like, Yurneya, you need to start paying attention to methodology. I mean, there is like no way around it.
Question on this. Is this commonplace amongst other molecular biologists?
Yes.
Where they don't really, wow.
Yes.
Okay. Because I know amongst doctors, like medical doctors who are in practice, they get sent medical journals and they really only have time to read the abstract because they're just seeing patient after patient. So they just read the abstract of a study and they're like, oh, okay, that's what the experts have determined for this. So that's how I'm going to practice now.
Yep. It's normal. And I can tell you that even when we are writing papers, we kind of put what we did in methodology, but sometimes it's like, oh, it's not exactly how I've done it. I mean, I don't remember if the temperature was 54 or 56. You know what I mean? Like minor things that then lead to people not really being able to reproduce what you've done. Right. So, I mean, there, even if we just stay on this level, like methods, we're like, okay, the whole thing about my paper is not methods. It's like, oh, I did this discovery and my abstract says it all. But then once you read through the whole thing and you see, oh, but actually what you say in your abstract, it's maybe not exactly what you found. So that has happened. I mean, I know that I have some papers that are questionable. And I mean, I know that now. And the thing is, nobody would even want to pull them. I mean, my boss didn't even pull the one that was really bad. So I'm like, okay, not even arguing with anybody at this point, but this is just how it is. And people won't admit it. That's that's the problem. But oh well, if we are trying to find the truth, we just have to go with it. And, you know, once you find what's true and real, you just go with it and stop playing games, because it's stupid, right?
And before we get into this, just again, for in layman's terms for the people that are listening, the context is the PCR test, so-called test, is testing for these primers that are derived from what Yurneya is about to explain right now regarding the sequencing of SARS-CoV-2 and other things.
Yeah, so it was only in June of 21. So I was listening to everything and I already accepted sometime during the winter of 2021, right? That first winter, I already accepted, okay, there is no viruses, but I haven't really looked myself into sequencing. But then I was asked in Slovenia to write a paper. They just wanted a paper from me about PCR and how PCR is bad. But if you keep cycles low enough, so then it's acceptable. So some cases are real, and then some are not real because the number of cycles is too high. And I
was there argument on that, that like, okay, we understand that if the cycle threshold is way too high, if you're running too many cycles, then you're picking up molecules of this so-called pathogen, or pieces of RNA or DNA associated with a so-called pathogen that may be inert at this point. And this person isn't actually sick. So if we run a much lower cycle threshold and then they still test, quote, positive, then that person is definitely sick with the pathogen. So this is a valid positive test.
Yes. So these were actually people on our side, again, quote unquote, on our side, because they're long lost on the wrong side. They just don't want to go to see the full truth. So I was asked to write a paper and I'm like, okay, I already know that this whole thing is, so let me go and start digging into sequencing. So I went and pulled the first papers that were published, right, of first patients that were sequenced in China. So this one, yeah, it's New England Journal of Medicine, but I don't know. I mean, and it's a brief report. So usually what a brief report tells me is already that there won't be much about materials and methods. Like methodology won't be really specifically written out, right? So they kind of write about, I'm not reading, we don't care. So they kind of write how they did it with some software and then some PCR, but they don't really give sequences, they give nothing specific. Okay, they just tell you what software they use to kind of analyze this and whatever. So I'm like, okay, I cannot do anything with this. So then another one, I don't know if there was another from a patient from Korea. So I don't remember if that was that one, but definitely there is this from March 7th, March 2020. the first patient in the US. So what is interesting is that this is the screenshot from maybe a month ago. So this article is still a preprint. So what does it mean? It has still not been peer reviewed. This tells me everything. This tells me everything I need to know. I mean, as much as I don't trust peer review, because the way it's conducted, it's like, it's really like a clown show. Because yeah. I mean, when you submit,
it's like a good old boys club, right?
Yes, yes. Because you submit and you sometimes you are asked, who do you want us to send this paper for review? And then, of course, if you are a young scientist, maybe you don't know many people, but you work with a primary investigator who's been in this business for like 40 years. So he's like, oh, yeah, yeah, we have that guy that kind of knows what we do and let's send it to him. So, and usually it gets reviewed and approved. Yeah, they might comment something, right? But so even if I think that about peer review, but still for if you stay in when it has to be peer reviewed for all these like people that still call themselves scientists that like do whatever they're doing in the labs, it needs to be peer reviewed and this has not been peer reviewed, then it's a little weird. I mean, to me, this is a little weird, right? So whole genome sequencing. So what they do in this paper, they already start. So whole genome sequencing was done with 37 pairs of nested PCR assays or PCR primers, I would say. They don't even write properly methodology, so tells me everything I need to know, again, even about the lab. Spanning the genome were designed based on the reference sequence, gene bank accession number, so-and-so. So I pulled up, this is actually the sequence that was sequenced in the next paper that I will discuss, which is the paper where they really have the methodologies there and you can really kind of understand what they did, right? So, and here they actually put in, so positive PCR amplicon, so they amplified stuff, right? They designed 37 pairs of these nested primers, so they would span across this genome that, again, was constructed in a computer, as we will see. And they run these resulting PCR products. They run them through this Oxford Nanopore Mini Ion sequencing. So it's this fancy technology that people are so, oh, it's an amazing technology that can sequence the whole genome. Yes, it can. Or the whole molecule, right? Yes, it can, if you give it the whole molecule. If you give it PCR products, it will just sequence exactly the way the other types of next generation sequences are being sequenced, right? And then construct and then stitch together. So we'll touch on this nanopore later on. So this one...
Real quick, this was designed based on the reference sequence GenBank accession number NC045512. So can you explain what you think went on there specifically?
So this paper is the one that published that where they deposited that sequence. Okay, so it's a Nature paper, a new coronavirus associated with human respiratory disease in China. And this one, I mean, when you read through, do you want to read this, Alec? Because me and my pronunciation. I mean, this is just.
Yeah, you're doing great on pronunciation, by the way, but sure, I'll read this. Okay, so the article is titled A New Coronavirus Associated with Human Respiratory Disease in China. And then this is what it says. Epidemiological investigations have suggested that the outbreak was associated with the seafood market in Wuhan. Here we study a single patient. That's interesting. A single patient who was a worker at the market and who was admitted to the Central Hospital of Wuhan on 26th of December 2019 while experiencing a severe respiratory syndrome that included fever, dizziness, and a cough. Metagenomic RNA sequencing of a sample of bronchiolavage fluid, that's BALF, right? I'm the patient identified of a new RNA virus strain from the family Coronaviridae, which is a designated here, in quotes, WH human 1 coronavirus, and has also been referred to as 2019 novel coronavirus, now called SARS-CoV-2.
So, I mean, so this is a summary of the abstract of this paper that was published or that was accepted at the end of January 2020. I mean, severe respiratory syndrome that included fever, dizziness, and cough. Nobody ever had something like this before, ever. I think, I don't know.
Yeah, I remember watching a video of Dr. Dan Wilson. He's also a molecular biologist that tends to slander and misrepresent the opinions of people like you and me and Kaufman and others. He brought up on one of his videos that with this initial patient, they tested him via a variety of tests, and they all came back negative for known, quote, known viruses. So therefore, it must be a new virus. So then that's when they did the sequencing process on this initial patient.
Yes.
And even the fallacies, the fallacious reasoning there. So if you don't test positive via this nonsensical test for these other viruses, then it must be a new one.
Yes, that's a good point. Nobody, I mean, when you go in WebMed, WebMD, where all medical doctors kind of go when looking for, oh, maybe it could be this, when they have some sort of some symptoms that they don't know what it might be, you can find chemical pneumonia. You can find it. And it has exactly the same things, right? It,
especially in a place like Wuhan, right? Yes. Where the air pollution is god-awful.
Yes, exactly. So they definitely didn't look into that. They just tested for all the other viruses, and it was none of those. And I'm questioning. I mean, I've been in the lab for long enough. I've been questioning my, not just coworkers. I've been questioning because I hear stories from people, from grad students. They were like, Yernaya, that person did that, that person did. I mean, and when I repeated, it didn't show up like that. So, I mean, I've been around for way too long to be fooled by certain things. I mean, this is just what comes with age, right? I mean, not just the glasses to see.
Clearing out your body of toxins and taking care of yourself so then you're reconnected with your intuition.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what is metagenomic sequencing? Metagenomic sequencing is, so you people usually don't understand that scientists are just a little grown-up kids. So when you show them some sort of a new technology, they are like, I told you, right, Alec, like you give a new dinosaur or a new car toy to your kid, will be like all over. And if you show a scientist a new supercomputer, a new software, a new something, something, they'll be like, oh, this is the thing. So metagenomic,
like a kid on Christmas morning.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. This is exactly what it is. Right. So what you do first, you shred genetic material in a way that you only have short reads. You only have pieces of the genetic material that are very short. And you do this sequencing. And then through a computer, you assemble it into the viral genome. Ta-da! So when you look into this paper, when you look in methodology, I actually wrote it in a, I created this thing, so it's a little easier to maybe see. So there were 56 and more million of these short reads that are around 100-150 nucleotides. And then they used two different programs to assemble these reads. Okay, so MegaHit assembled around 384,000 different assemblies. And Trinity assembled 1,330,000 assemblies. And these assemblies could go from really short, like 200 to all the way to 30,000. Or in the case, so in the case with Trinity, we only went from 200 to 11,760. So now my question would have been, if you have two different softwares, right? Mm-hmm. And one assembles. Let's assume that this is your genome, right? Let's assume. Mm-hmm. But why this guy only gets up to 11,760? So yeah. as the biggest assembly that it can assemble, right? Mm-hmm. So all of these, so first how these computer programs work, you need to program them, right? So a person needs to set in certain parameters, sequences. I can show you. So what happens very often, let's say if I had a T here, very often my computer would still assemble these two together. Even if here was a T, just imagine that everything is a little longer, so the overlapping area is a bit bigger. So maybe that T is one out of 20 that is not complementary to what is on the other side, right? But still, the computer would say, oh, yeah, just forget them. It's okay. So it's calculating probability. It's calculating what is the probability that this guy over here, even if it has a T, can assemble here. So
and what we're talking about for the people who are just listening is we're talking about taking these short reads, which are 100 to 150 nucleotides. And as an example, for one of the reads, it would be like ATTTGCGC. And then that is known to, based on a construct of another theoretical virus, to overlap at another point with another short read at, you know, GTTGCTAG, based on a construct of the genome of another so-called virus.
I mean, it's a computer that was trained, that was programmed to do certain things, and it's all probability calculation. What's mm-hmm. the probability that these two pieces go together? And then at the end, of course, they matched it with something. Oh, yeah, but it's similar to, was it bat? SARS,
BLC, COVE, whatever, I forget what it is. It's like
It's similar to this, so this is what it is. Okay, so it's just a new type of
89% similar too, I think, 89. Is what they found. 89, and it's like I forget who pointed this out. It is either Cowan or Kaufman, but it's like I'm 89% similar to a house cat. Like, you know what I mean? Maybe even a little bit more similar to a house cat. So the fact that they're saying that this is a variation of a previous so-called coronavirus because it's 89% similar is nonsense.
Exactly. And again, scientists should know that. I mean, they should immediately be like, okay, it's not, but they've trained us. I mean, I know that for me, I know that I'm, 98% similar to a chimp? But if something else, so I accept that as we are not the same, but then if these two viruses are 89% similar, but they're the same. So, I mean, it's just weird how we operate up in the brain, right? I mean, how it all goes. We just ignore certain things and it's the same, but it's a huge difference. Oh, yeah, but it's the same. So, but another thing that this methodology showed me was they actually don't write it, right? So what they do, they have all of these reads, right, that we said 56 million reads. And what they do, they actually at one point went and filtered out the non-human reads. So what you do, you throw all of these reads and you align them to human genome. Okay, so we have the human genome and we know the sequence. So you throw everything at it and whatever doesn't align is non-human reads. So all of a sudden, when you, again, it's like reading between the lines. Non-human reads, 23 million, right? So when you go, how many are human reads? 32 million. So what does it tell me? That the virus is not purified. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the clear example that what we, even if RNA was purified via a viral RNA purification kit, here it says, I mean, it's between the lines because this number is not written in methodology, right? So this mm-hmm. is my mind that subtracted stuff, because I mean, I learned math at school, although it's racist, so be careful, right? So yeah, so the secret sample has not been purified. So it's clear that the virus is not isolated. It's not, because again, what is isolation should be, I mean, if I isolate my cat, one cat away from the other cat, it means I will put one in one freaking room and the other one in the other, right? I mean, I won't be keeping them together if I'm isolating them. But no, for them, isolation, we know. I mean, I think who explains it well? Christine Massey explains well the isolation, I think, and Amanda. So there are people that explain the whole there, how virologists isolate, right?
I can do that real quick just to set the context for people who are jumping in on this episode without having any context on that piece specifically. So they take an unpurified sample of snot from a sick person or other fluids from a sick person. They then assume that that snot or fluid contains virus particles in it without ever verifying that it does. They'll then sometimes centrifuge it, separating particles by weight, essentially by density, or they'll sometimes filter it, separating particles of known size out from it. They'll get this substance. They'll then add it to viral transport medium. Viral transport medium contains at a minimum amphotericin B and gentamicin, which are known to be cytotoxic specifically to kidney cells. And the context for that is they're adding that substance then onto a monkey kidney cell from an adult green monkey, which is called a Vero E6 or a Vero CCL81. Both of those are coming from an adult green monkey, two different cell lines. And then they'll also add on more gentamicin, more amphotericin B, more penicillin, streptomycin, fetal bovine serum, and then they'll add either Delbecco's minimal essential medium or Delbecco's modified eagle medium. The cell will then experience what is called a cytopathic effect, breaking down into a bunch of fragments. It'll then take those fragments and prepare them for electron microscopy, which is a process in and of itself that is loaded with assumptions. Electron microscopy produces artifacts, and then they'll produce these electron micrograph images, and then they'll point to the particles on those images and say, voila, those are the virus particles. This must be what caused this cell to experience sickness. This must be what was inside the patient's fluid, even though we never validated that was actually there. This must be what was causing this person to be sick. This must have been transmitted from another person.
Thank you for explaining, Alec, because people need to understand what's going on, right?
Yep.
So I think, I mean, this pretty much is what showed me, okay, so even as if I go as a scientist, if I disregard whatever Dr. Lanka showed, what he did, measles and that whole thing, I mean, disregarding everything, just taking these papers and reading through them properly, it clearly shows that something is off.
Yeah.
And again, why a scientist? I mean, when they see this, they're like, oh yeah, because it's different parameters, it's normal. They just somehow justify why this is acceptable. That two different softwares produce different things. It's not because the whole thing is fake, but it's because, oh yeah, it's just, you know, they just operate in a different way and this and that. So it's, I mean, and when you really go and look, the sequence is not even, so the longest sequence, it's not even complete. It's not even what then they report as the full sequence in with that code, with the assessment.
Is that where they go in and they add some sequences that are missing and just assume that somehow they were lost in translation through the process?
Yes. Yes.
And that's an important point. Someone mentioned in the comments that's watching live, can you please make the distinction that this is not a sequencing, but rather an alignment process?
So I don't know. I have no clue what's going on, right? I mean, we don't know what happens in the metagenomic sequencing process, in next generation sequencing process, because so when we are sequencing one short PCR product, okay, we see, let's say we see the sequence as each nucleotide has its own fluorophore, has its own, let's call it its own color. So the way sequencing works, when the nucleotide is present. Let's say it's a C, you get yellow when it's a T. So you actually see again with your eyes, and then you just realize that that is also just an effect of something that you are not really seeing, DNA. But that's beside the point. But let's say you see something here. It's stuff is thrown into the computer. Sequences you never really see. You don't know what sequencing reaction did, right? Everything is tossed into the computer, and then computer analyzes. What I can tell you is that, let's go here. It's just easier. So let's say I've looked at these assemblies. Okay, so when we've done human genome sequencing of patients, when we were looking for mutation in that specific patient, that would be maybe the explanation of why people in that family have cancer. Okay, so what you do, you sequence a lot of individuals in the family. Let's say they all have some sort of, I don't know, they have breast cancer, right? So, and then you see, will they all share a certain mutation? So will in one spot there always be something? Like instead of in your reference genome, you have a G, but then in your patient, you might have a C, okay? So I've looked at these assemblies, and my computer called something a mutation. So my computer would say, oh yeah, there is in this gene, in this person, you actually have a T in place of an A. Then I went looking and I'm like, this is a little weird because the distribution is not the way I expect it to be. I mean, there are several parameters that you look at. So computer does some sort of a filtering, but then by eye, I was doing it like really manually and looking at them. And then I'm like, I'm not really convinced that this is real. Then what you do, you take the PCR and you just amplify that gene and you sequence it again. You just do a Sanger sequencing reaction. And what usually happens, there was no mutation. And this has happened over and over and over again. Wow. So the computer considered that person as having a mutation in a certain gene, in a certain, right, in a certain position. And you went and confirmed and it was not there. So, I mean, there are so many things. And again, I can say this because of experience. It's not because of what I read in the book or, you know, it's really what I saw and what I was dealing with, because we were trying to figure out, oh, then is there a shared mutation in all of these people? And most time we didn't find anything. Of course, we were just looking in coding regions. We were not looking in the non-coding regions, but then now I would also explain it. It's not mutations, it's other stuff. So apart from that, right? What's really causing cancer in that family, right? Like in that so many people in that family have cancer.
I don't want to keep interrupting, but this is a good comment. John Blade, who's watching, said, how can one in advance even know which of the two software programs is more correct when doing the assembling of something that has never been, quote, discovered before?
Of course you don't know. So I guess we just use what we have, right? So it's like you just use what you have. And I mean, everything is guided by what you want to find. I mean, they wanted to find, so we already said they wanted to find a virus, right? They were testing just for viruses in that first Wuhan patient. Right? One patient. They tested for viruses, known viruses. Everything was negative. And then all of a sudden, they're like, okay, yeah, then it must be a novel virus. So you really find what you look for. And they just, okay, yeah, we usually use these two softwares. And that's what it is. I mean, what you get out, you don't really know what you will get out. But I mean, I'm questioning.
I mean, the implications of that, though, as you point out here, again, for those listening, is that, okay, so there's 56.5 million short reads that are coming from this unpurified sample of fluid from a sick person. Mm-hmm. And then they are put into Megahidden Trinity. Megahidden Trinity assembles those short reads and they get completely different results Megahit gets anywhere from 200 to 30,000 nucleotides, and then Trinity gets 200 to 11,000 nucleotides. And then what they did is they filtered out anything that was a like compared to the human genome, and even without getting into to that, that's all a lot of assumptions itself too. But the human reads were 32.5 million of those, and then the non-human reads were 23.5 million. And so it sort of makes you sit back and question, like, oh my God, this is very clearly not coming from an isolated virus particle or isolated virus particles, because there's 23.5 million non-human reads in this sample. And again, they're only the short reads, because so anything that was a longer read, which, you know, I would imagine would represent a more complete genome of an organism, they had to throw that to the side, because this computer program can only work with short reads.
Yeah, I mean, it's so the way it's done, is you pretty much extract all this RNA that now we know it's not just coming from virus. Let's say if there is a virus, but it's just coming from the whole sample. And what they do, they actually do chop it with molecular scissors. Usually it's it could be sonication. So you kind of, with the sound, disrupt. So that's how.
Got it. So they're not setting aside anything that's over 150 base pairs. They're just like chopping up anything that's over 150 base pairs.
So you chop it up, and then you check it if all of your products are short. And I don't know. I've never done it myself, but I've kind of worked with somebody. So I don't know if sometimes they really just take everything that's between 100 and 150, what you see on the gel. Again, what is that separation? I mean, we can go into like really molecular biology, but that would be a little too much. But what I can say is, really, sometimes I would say they would even just take. So even if there is smaller stuff or longer stuff, right? Longer reads, they would just take the ones that fit the what they want, the 100, 150 nucleotides, if that makes sense. And then run those through sequencing.
Got it. Okay, I'm done interrupting now. Back to you.
Yeah, no, I think that's it with sequencing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is what I have, and I think it was kind of understandable. But again, you can see this and close your eyes and ignore everything and just move on with your, you know, I'm this scientist and whatever, or you can say, wait a minute. So this didn't make sense, and this didn't make sense in my life, like over the years. This didn't make sense. And then connecting it to, I mean, because so many things connected for me, like so many other things. Like, it's not just like science. Then I'm started, why are there so many freaking homeless? If we are the best nation in the world, I mean, why is the, and California is, oh, such amazing people, and the amount of hope. I mean, everything. So I started questioning why this, why that. And then I'm like, oh, because, and let's not go into this conspiracy theory of whatever, but
don't even need to. You can show how ridiculous and nonsensical the government is with its spending and its authority and what is promoted in the mainstream without even going into any conspiracy theories.
Yeah, yes. And I mean, it's, this is when you really connect all the different pieces that you've come across over time, and then you're like, wait, I mean, to me, what it really happened, I'm like, if we take this down, because this is all fake, this is all false, everything that we are doing in medical research is not for our benefit. I mean, it's clear that it's not, right? So if we take all of this down, then everybody will be happy. I mean, to me, it was like, it won't be just me as a scientist who has a good position. You know, I mean, I have a decent life. I cannot complain. But I've seen too much over time. I volunteered with a food pantry when I was still in Ohio. And it's ridiculous. I mean, a zip code east from the Ohio State University. I mean, we are not talking some University of Alabama or whatever. I mean, not to put anybody down. You know what I mean?
But like, yeah, I get what you mean though, yeah.
They always put that D in front of it. So
yes, of course.
Ohio State University, right? a zip code over. And then you hear people that work at the Ohio State University Medical Center, they go, oh, but in Columbus, we don't have homeless. Oh, who am I working with on Saturdays? Am I working with like air? I mean, it's the experience led me to really connect and really say, okay, and realize we can actually do something. Because right now it's like, before I would just complain and say, oh, I can volunteer, but I'm really not. We can actually do something, and we are doing something. I know that we are doing something huge, and we are turning the ship around, although it's, and we get attacked. I mean, we get attacked like there's no tomorrow, but who said it would be easy when we signed up for this?
Amen. Right? Yeah, it really is God's work, though. We're helping people to turn back to themselves instead of blindly outsourcing the experts. We're helping to dissolve this conditioning that we've been subject to for God knows how long.
Yep. Way too long. I mean, we all trusted doctors, right? Mm-hmm. So this article is March 12, 2020. So I think I came across this maybe in June or July, like later on in the summer, where a decent, you know, Psychology Today, so it's not just what I would say like Columbus Dispatch or LA Times, they're actually showing how coronavirus anxiety can make you feel sick. So I was, okay. So again, in my head, I'm like, yeah, this makes sense. So they run all of those big numbers, what you brought up earlier, right? So they run all of those big numbers of cases and people get anxious. People start having problems breathing. And what happens? You go to the emergency room. And what were they doing in the emergency rooms in April, May, June, July? I mean, constantly. Even now they're still testing. They would test. And all the tests were coming back positive, pretty much all of them, because of high cycle number. So as I said before, you can manipulate it if you increase, even if they were not contaminated, the swabs or something. Some people are like, oh, this was already like, it was already saying it was positive because something was on the swab or in the liquid, whatever. You don't even need that, because if you ramp up the cycles, chances are that something will glow. Chances are very high.
Yeah. So, and that's the point. It's like, yes, it's not that there's false positives or false negatives. It's that all the results are diagnostically and scientifically meaningless because you don't have an actual thing that you have proven is the cause of any sort of anything whatsoever that you're testing against. It's all based on assumption. It's all based on what you described here. But yes, of course, increasing the cycle threshold, you will get more frequent positive results, I'd imagine, is what I'm saying, right?
Yes, you will just get like... the way I saw it, of course, everybody that gets into the emergency room with this like a panic attack, they would test positive. And you test positive, again, this is the human brain is amazing. You test positive and they were just rolling death numbers on CNN and you immediately go, oh, I'm going to die. You go in this loop and you start programming yourself, right? You were already programmed and you just keep doing it and just spinning and going.
And then the toxic assault of remdesivir, all the like stuff that's assaulting your body associated with being put on a ventilator, like all of those things in combination were the perfect recipe for leading people to death.
Yes. So coming as a positive to an emergency room was pretty much a death sentence because of remdesivir and all of that stuff that they were doing. And yeah, I know a nurse who works at Kaiser, and she was believing, because they put so much fear into this, like people, right, working in hospitals and stuff. So she pretty much went with the thing and was believing that everything was real, although her husband was like screaming, no, but it's not. And then I didn't know her at the beginning, and then I came across her. So we met at the end of 2020 and we started talking. So the first time I said something about the virus, she looked at me like, Renee, you're a little crazy. And then now she's like, wow, Renee, I'm looking at everything completely different. And it's like, wow, what have we been doing? And she was not directly involved. She's a supervisor. But she actually told me that somebody, again, from, she's actually from former Yugoslavia, who I guess moved some time ago. And she's also a nurse. And she felt comfortable because this woman is from my country also. And she felt comfortable and said, I think we're doing something wrong because we're following what doctors tell us. And they're telling us something that I think is not right to, you know, as treatment for these people. So they felt that something was off, but they couldn't understand what was going on. I think a lot of nurses were just completely lost. Completely lost, and then was fear, losing the job. I mean, it's not fun, right? Especially you live in California, it's even harder than if you lose it in some other state where prices are a little lower, right? So you lose a job here, it's bad. So yeah, so it was a vicious cycle of fear and yeah, that's that. So
yeah, can I bring up that CDC study real quick? Share my screen on that just to show people again. Yeah. I think this adds some more context to what you're saying with that article that you just shared. So this was set out to determine underlying medical conditions and severe illness among 540,000 people hospitalized with quote COVID-19, and the results, what it showed is that the strongest risk factors for death were obesity, which is not surprising. And then the second strongest risk factor was anxiety and fear-related disorders. So now I'd imagine that means that those are people who had already had a diagnosed fear/anxiety-related disorder, not accounting for the large number of people who were just in a perpetual state of fear and anxiety, wound up in the hospital, wound up being put on remdesivir, ventilator, and all those things. So that's just kind of showing the magnitude that fear plays into this so-called disease, into the whole COVID trade over the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that paper. I think you shared it in some other presentation, and I'm like, that's what it is. I mean, and they write it, and it's there. So
it's literally a CDC study. That's what's crazy about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I agree. So I mean, I wanted to just touch upon just a couple of things. So I started looking and I went back and tried to figure out when nanopore started to be used a little more frequent and this and that. I mean, I've heard about it, but I have not really been doing next generation sequencing for the last maybe 4 or 5 years. So if there is something new, I'm really not up to date. I'm kind of working on a little different stuff right now. But so I found this paper from, let's say, December 2020. And clearly, so it's Nature Communications, Analytical Validity of Nanopore Sequencing for Rapid SARS-CoV-2 Genome Analysis. So they clearly, this is in methodology, they clearly say, we know that it is not possible to amplify the entire SARS-CoV-2 genome in this way, whichever way that is. And they pretty much use for sequencing of SARS-CoV-2, they use an established protocol by ARTIC, A-R-T-I-C, probably abbreviation of something, Network for Viral Surveillance. So this sequencing protocol, I won't open it. I won't go into it. It says that, so it's here. It's summarized here. PCR with 98 times 400 base pair amplicons. So again, it's 98 different amplicons. So different, each one of those with forward reverse primer that I talked about when I was explaining, each one of those is called an amplicon because you amplify a certain region. So 98, these different amplicons they used that span the whole SARS-CoV-2 genome, just as based on that sequence, that's the accession number and something, something, something that was constructed in the computer from that one patient. So that is based on, this is based on sequence assembled on a computer, right? So yes, they are using this fancy technology, but they are definitely not feeding the full RNA from the virus into this machine so it would sequence. Okay, so we want to make that clear because it sounded like just because this nanopore can sequence the full genome or a very long reads, it doesn't mean that they sequenced for the SARS-CoV-2 genome analysis. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that they sequenced the whole, because, and it's written here, it's clearly not. So some people hate to read methodology because it's time consuming. So it looks like most people just skip that, because if somebody would have read this, wouldn't be saying that they're sequencing the whole genome of this SARS-CoV-2 with this nanopore. So that's my thing. And here it's in clinical routine lab. So there are several papers that are kind of nanopore sequencing in a clinical routine laboratory, challenges and opportunities. So clinical clean lab publications, and they actually call out their challenges. And I don't remember what year this was. So if one goes and Googles a little bit, you'll be like, okay, so it's not yet completely clear if it's usable or not, what are pluses, minuses, what are the problems, but people just quote it and say, oh yeah, it's okay and we can use it and so on and so forth. So for people to understand how scientific papers work and how citing for like older papers works. So let's say research done in this is let me see the date, April 2020. So this is Journal of Virology, receptor recognition by the novel coronavirus from Wuhan, an analysis based on decade-long structural studies of SARS-CoV-2. So structural studies are very often done in a computer. So first,
can you can pull this one up?
You can.
Yeah,
you can.
Here, I got it. Here we go.
Based on the rich knowledge about SARS-CoV-2. So SARS-CoV-2 is the first virus, right? For the first respiratory syndrome that happened in the SARS-CoV-2 outbreak in 2002. And they say they've looked into this RBD, receptor binding domain, in, I guess, in the spike protein. I mean, I don't even care. It's all, to me, it's all nonsense. But just to point out that here, they just say, so first the sequence of this new SARS-CoV-2, here it's named like this, but SARS-CoV-2, RBD, so the receptor binding domain, including its receptor binding motif that directly contacts ACE2, is similar to the original SARS-CoV virus. So first, using the word similar. Similar is not same.
No.
It's similar.
Again, especially considering the context that they said that it's 89% similar to the bat BL, whatever that one. I pulled it up earlier. It's from Mark Bailey's paper. It's bats SL-CoV-ZC45, but that it's 89% similar. Like when they say similar, like what? That means that they're like both two things that they've shown to like just be things. And they actually haven't even done that. But the point is that like what they mean by similar means nothing when they're saying that 89% similar is said to mean something, you know?
Yes. Yes, exactly. So if for them 89% of similarity is high similarity, when, I mean, you and I, we might look similar, you know, as, I mean, but we are not, definitely we're not the same, right?
And ironically, we're like 99.9 something percent similar, probably.
Yeah, so, yes, and probably, yeah. I would say even more, because yeah. I mean, the genes are there, right? So, yeah. And then they say strongly suggesting. I mean, what does it mean, strongly suggesting? That this new SARS-CoV-2 uses ACE2 as its receptor. So this is how, this is their hypothesis, how this virus enters the cells, right? I think that's, that was the point of this whole research. Several critical residues, and then they talk about, I mean, stuff, all of these different, several critical residues in the SARS-CoV-2 provide favorable interactions with human ACE2. This was all done on a computer. So what you do, you have a computer model. It's a 3D. It's again, one of these playing. I mean, we were doing this. My husband was playing with it in 2001, 2002. He was enjoying it. I mean, he's a boy. So, you know, you give him a computer and, you know, with a mouse, and he was like turning this molecule around, and he's like, oh, and if you substitute this amino acid lysine with arginine, oh, look, 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 this changes. And I mean, it's, we've played with this. So now it's just more modern and whatever, maybe up to date, but it's still just a computer simulation, right? But the point is that a lot of later papers go and call this, I mean, they completely ignore that here it only says is similar to. They just say, oh, it is, and that's it. So they just, all of this similar, maybe strongly suggests, they would call that this paper showed that SARS-CoV-2 via spike protein or whatever directly contacts ACE2, and that's it. So they would just take it as a claim, not here it may be something indicated something. So that's how most papers work, right? You just go, and even if some paper was just mentioning, oh, maybe this could be, you just run with it. You just say, oh, that paper showed, and that's it. And only now that I started questioning things, I'm seeing I have done more. I have done that more than once. So I wanted to point out how we base a lot of stuff like that we do when we look back at some papers and this paper 100% showed when it
clearly. Well, and that brings up the issue with the reproducibility crisis amongst science. And like, of course, this is an appeal to, or a bandwagon fallacy and an appeal to authority in one. And it's in Nature magazine, or Nature, the medical journal. And it says more than 70% of researchers have tried and failed to reproduce another scientist's experiments, and more than half have failed to reproduce their own experiments. Mm-hmm. So again, it's that science is based on all science, quote, science in air quotes today, is based on all these unproven assumptions that build and build and build and build and build off of each other. And then the problem is that's taught in textbooks, that's taught amongst, you know, public universities and private universities, and taught in laboratories. And then it establishes this false scientific consensus where everyone knows this is what it is, even though it's all based on assumptions and nonsense. And then the other thing that I thought was relevant to bring up for this too is, ironically, these two are both are really caught in the delusion of scientism. But the editor-in-chief of The Lancet, Richard Horton, was quoted as saying, "The case against science is straightforward. Much of the scientific literature, perhaps half, may simply be untrue. Afflicted by studies with small sample sizes, tiny effects, invalid exploratory analyses, and flagrant conflicts of interest, together with an obsession for pursuing fashionable trends of dubious importance, science has taken a turn towards darkness." So that's the editor-in-chief of The Lancet. And then we have this other one from Marcia Angel, the former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. "It is simply no longer possible to believe much of the clinical research that is published, or to rely on the judgment of trusted physicians or authoritative medical guidelines. I take no pleasure in this conclusion, which I reached slowly and reluctantly over my two decades as an editor of the New England Journal of Medicine." So I just thought those were also appropriate quotes to bring up as context for what we're talking about here.
Yes, if people have open eyes, like people as people in research, if we keep our eyes open, we see things, and then it's really on you what you want to do with it. Because I know that for a while I was ignoring it because I'm like, I cannot do anything anyway. I mean, with that science paper, I was screaming and still it was not pulled. I'm like, okay. And this was in 2008. This was in 2008.
This was a paper you co-authored, right? That's what you're referring back to?
No, this is the paper that I did not co-author.
Oh, okay.
This is the paper I was hired so I could continue building up on that research.
Got it.
And okay. Then I couldn't get some stuff to work. And it was just weird, of course, because that stuff was not there. I was not finding things that I was kind of being told to look for. Not that I was being told I have to find, but they were like, oh, there could be something here. So, Irnea, you do your magic as a molecular biologist. And I'm like, okay. And then it was the whole summer. So I started in May. It was the whole summer. And the lab manager goes to my primary principal investigator. Yes. And says, look, Irnea is working hard and she cannot get stuff to work. So, or you put her on another research project or she will walk because, you know, I mean, is she stupid? And no, it looks like I was just stubborn. And then luckily I stayed because then somebody else from another lab brought up, look guys, what you found in that paper, we cannot reproduce in our cohort of patients. So then we exchanged, everything happened. Like when I really started looking is when everything happened, when we sent our patient samples, like a certain number, up to them, and they send their stuff to us. And we started working as, okay, blindfolded kind of, we didn't know who was what, and let's see if we can find what was found before. And nobody could find nothing. Oh, wonder why. It was the PCR that was not done properly. Because I will just say, RNA samples were degraded. And the person didn't have enough knowledge, enough experience to really realize that RNA samples can degrade. I've been working with RNA since, probably from the beginning, from 95. So PCR technology as a technology, but then RNA molecules to study protein synthesis. So I kind of knew they were saying, oh, Irnea, if you just like talk over the tube, spit and RNAs, so enzymes that degrade RNA can jump in and you will have, you will have like no RNA. So I've been very cautious and this person probably just was not aware how to work with RNA. I don't know. So it's really through experience that you learn a lot. So that's why young people, if COVID happened when I was 25, oh Lordy. I would have been jabbed 100 masks,
fully bought in,
one on top of the other. I mean, full, would have been ridiculous, but oh well, not at twice that age. I mean, no, they're not fooling me anymore.
Well, thank goodness. Yeah, that's awesome. And again, this all goes back to the biased nature, the unproven presuppositions that have permeated all facets of the scientific community, the so-called scientific community. And science is no longer based in, seeing an observed phenomenon and trying to distinguish what is the cause from an unbiased approach. Like, okay, I really want to set out to determine what is the cause of this observed phenomenon. It's coming in with these preconceived notions, these biases, and you already have made up in your mind what the cause is, and then you go looking for ways to verify that that's the cause, and you come up with all these procedures and models and theories and simulations to match what you've already made up in your mind, and that's the problem.
Yes, and this is what I see. So there is an example of a student in biology class studying worms. And then the teacher asks about elephant. And the student that didn't study elephants goes, oh, the elephant has a trunk, looks like a worm, and goes with a hole. So this is what I observe when I see my PI now. When she talks with somebody and they bring up their own, let's say, okay, yeah, aging leads to breast cancer because of this pathway, that pathway. And she's been working with a specific pathway, with a specific set of genes, pretty much all of her life. So she leads everything slowly, slowly to her genes. To, I mean, it's ridiculous to watch how, just because they know something, they will lead everything there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's two PIs. One is good here and the other one is good here. And then depends who wins, right? Will one pull the other one in their direction or the other way around? But it's, I mean, when you observe, it's ridiculous. And it's impossible to get any funding. Of course, it's impossible to get any funding for any other type of research that you want to do. I mean,
I actually had another molecular biologist mention that to me on Twitter. He said, well, why don't you get one of your molecular biologist buddies to get a grant to do research to overthrow this whole industry if you think that's the case then?
This is clear. Most people have no clue for how funding works, right? I mean, it just tells you. So even there is a foundation, Breast Cancer Foundation or something in, it's a private foundation. I don't know who's behind it here in California. And so when I listened to the presentations, when people were kind of pitching their research to get funding, some of them made sense back in the day. Probably now, if I would listen to it again, I would be like, no, nothing makes sense. But at that point, something still made sense. But again, it's tough. So it was more into lifestyle. It was more looking into lifestyle. Some got the funding, but again, very often it was not really going to the cause of the problem. Okay, so let me tell you, one was in that there, I laughed hard. So there is this whole thing about, is it the TB? Is it, no, it's EBV in
Epstein-Barr virus.
In cows and in cow's milk. So we need to cure cow. So first, we already know the Epstein-Barr virus.
Yep.
Okay. So, but let's say if we go with there is a virus. Okay, fine.
Yep.
Let's go with that. So instead of saying, okay, maybe it's just, let's just not drink milk. No, they wanted to cure. Because, so what we know, breast cancer is promoted with cow's milk protein.
Mm-hmm.
It is. I mean, again, is it scientifically proven?
And I wonder if it's like raw milk versus pasteurized milk, though, too. But yes, yeah. I get
yeah.
your point.
I don't know, because again, that's one thing that was not really looked at. Mm-hmm. But so what they would say, we need to cure EBV. We need to cure cows from EBV, not just say, look, milk is anyway promoting breast cancer. So no, because this was like some years ago, because EBV was found to be causing breast cancer in women, but it's coming from the cows through milk. So let's cure cows. In this case, they are curing cows instead of just saying, because we already know, you know, milk is not really that good for you. So maybe just when you are predisposed or something, maybe just, you know, don't do that. No. I mean, they always go about it in a weird way. So when you look at them, it's like, wow.
Just assumptions on top of assumptions on top of assumptions. Yeah. Well, this has been an awesome conversation. I hope people are able to follow along. I think we broke it down in as much context as we can. Maybe what would be good, Yurneya, is to have you send me, or I already have your presentation. Maybe we'll post that on the way forward so we can link the actual presentation so people can view it if they're listening and sort of follow along watching the slides. But this is awesome. Thank you so much for doing this. And thank you for being brave enough to speak out on this, because I've had other molecular biologists message me and say, hey, I'm fully hip to the no virus thing. I've come to understand that it's all based on unproven assumptions, but I'm just too afraid to speak out. And I get it. I do get it. But thank goodness for people like you who are brave enough to speak out. And especially like you, this is, you know, something we talked about on the phone previously. It required you to dissolve your identity. You are not Yurneya, the molecular biologist. You are Yurneya. and you are even deeper than that. That's what you truly are. So it's much easier to dissolve that conditioning once you realize who you truly are.
Yeah. As I told you, because I've been working on this whole identity way before COVID. I mean, I was made aware that that is something that will have to go, my holding on to, you know, you're this, you're that. So that's why, I mean, my diploma has always been under my bed, rolled up under my bed. And I was not even aware what actually that means. Because everybody that puts it very proudly on the, I mean, this really puts you in a different space, right? This really puts you as, okay, my diploma. And mine was always under the bed. At some point, I thought I actually tossed it, but no. It doesn't matter. To me, it doesn't matter. And especially as I was feeding the homeless in Columbus, I had amazing conversations with people that were like homeless and toothless. And I mean, it was insane. And this guy was like, I don't care about Buckeyes and all of that. I go into the library, you know, I grab a book and I read. I'm like, wow. Wow. Yeah. I mean, it's completely insane who you meet when you kind of step out of this freaking ivory tower where as you said before, we are building fake reality. Because as you were saying that we are going and further away from nature, scientists build this completely fake reality where nothing is real, nothing is true, and everything is upside down. Mm-hmm. Cause effect is the other. I mean, everything is completely inverted. Mm-hmm. So once you see that, but it's scary. It's scary at the beginning, but if you know that actually taking this whole thing down will be better for everybody, then it's not a problem. And I promised to a friend, he said, Irnea, you should never be afraid. This was April 2020. I'm like, I promise I'll never be afraid. I still am afraid every now and then. I'm like, oh boy. And then they find me and then they kick me out from my work. And if they do, they do. I mean, religious exemption went through. I was willing to walk. Even my husband, we were like, if it doesn't go through, we won't be like sweating it and like screaming at them and doing, if it goes through, fine. If it doesn't, oh well. So somehow
you're a brave woman.
Working. I'm from Slovenia, so we're stubborn. That's a real thing.
I talked with you about that, how I have Serbian in me. That's like my last name, Zek, is actually Zec, which means rabbit in Serbian, and Serbians are known to be against authority. So this is just in the nature of you and I guess, is where we come from, to question authority and to not give any shits on, you know, how people perceive us. So
yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Irnea. This was awesome. This was so great.